This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Solana. Pablo Angel takes it in his path brilliantly. Wolves under real pressure here, and Angel passes it into the net. Resistance again from Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast, the all killer, no filler Aston Villa podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of MyOldManSaid.com. Thank you for joining us. Joining me, Mr. Dan Rogers from the Villa Underground. Welcome back.
Hello, hello, hello.
Four shows on the trot.
Fantastic. It's like I've got nothing else to do. No. I'm delighted to be here, not under duress.
And Mr. Chris Burt, who keeps the show going. Thank you very much for joining us again.
You're welcome.
How are you, gents? Anything novel happening in your lockdown experiences?
Well, my adopted claret and blue team on the Faroe Islands did excellent at the weekend, David.
What happened? I'm sure they couldn't have scored. Surely.
Well, they were 5-0 down after half an hour.
Wasn't it 3-0 in the first 10 minutes?
Yes, minor details.
We've just detected that Chris Budd has been following this.
Yeah, this is great fun.
This sport.
Feel free to go to villaunderground.com, click on the ABR gear link.
He's actually set up, I can't believe you set up like some kind of blog. For how many people? 3? 4?
Well, that's. Are you looking? So it's just me and Chris at this point, I think. And Christopher, friend of the show, Christopher.
Our friend Christopher. We'll give him a shout out later on. We've found some kind of Norwegian connection.
There's actually more people following it online than at the ground.
I think there's more people following it online than live in the Faroe Islands. So,
so double figures then. Just. How are you, Mr. Bud?
I'm very well. Became an uncle for the second time. Thank you very much.
Wow. Yeah. And when are you going to have kids of your
Fuck
own?
Fuck knows.
Fair enough. Nothing happening in my universe, really. It's my birthday, and my mother sent me a slow cooker.
Oh. So you've had a slow cooker
present.
And a shitload of beer today.
I've done a bit of beef in it, and it was fantastic, actually. If you want the best tasting meat and probably veg, cooking it for 8-10 hours in a slow cooker is another universe.
Slow cooked brisket.
You've not eaten anything from a kiosk at Villa Park. Only then would you know true cuisine or the fortitude of your stomach.
You have managed quite successfully, I've noticed, when editing the show, to slip in Villa Dog in all of your appearances.
He gets a fee. He's on commission.
You are sponsored.
It's like guerrilla
marketing.
I'm
sure of it. Coming up in the show, Villa are back in full contact training. The women's team have got the promotion green light, despite Graham Souness's master plan. Will the ghost stadiums or behind closed doors format actually suit Villa, because they have allegedly players that tend to freeze or suffer when there's a crowd baying for their blood or putting pressure on. And in the overrated or underrated, our trio of villains are the mercurial Mustafa Hadji, Earl Barrett, and Mr. Sasha Churchich. Right, first of all, we'll just blast into the villain news. Full contact training was always happening and the season was happening as soon as we saw that the news that Sky Sports were unpausing their subscriptions. That was a clue. It was a bit like in the American elections when you're up at night seeing for early indications of whether Clinton was going to get in or Trump was going to get in. And you saw the Mexican peso drop like a lead balloon.
Nosedived.
Trump's got this. That was the first indication because the wall was coming up. So as soon as Sky was we're talking about unpausing, we knew it was up and running. And Villa are well into their competitive training at this stage. They've already had a kind of a competitive training exercise against the Baggies, who brought two teams worth of players to Villa Park. So Villa Park could actually road test Villa Park as a COVID ghost stadium, as well as the players getting some minutes. And John McGinn, I think, got half an hour, did he not?
Yeah, they played, was it like three quarters of 30 minutes or something, apparently. It was kind of a bit of a strange setup, how they did it.
Yeah, I think there would just been a rotation of players, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the scores, academic, I think it was 2-2, doesn't mean jack, though. At this time, it's just hard to get proper preseason games in because most of the lower league teams, like your Telfords, your Kidderminsters, are all in their close season, so there's nobody around to actually play. But there'll be games, obviously, as the Premier League kicks off on June the 17th, with Villa starting first, 6 p.m. UK time on that Wednesday night against Sheffield United. Just quickly, it was only the initial fixtures that have been confirmed at the time of the show. Sheffield United is followed swiftly by Chelsea at home also, then Newcastle, then Wolves at home also. So in those first four fixtures, we've got three home games. So Mr. Bird, you would expect they need to get some points from them. I mean, preferably we should win that Sheffield United game. If we get some points in these first four games, three at home, then if there is a second wave, then we'll be in a decent place to stay in the league for next season.
Yeah, I think you want to sort of take the stance that let's just get out the bottom three as fast as possible and then take it week by week, because you just don't know, as you said, where the line's going to be drawn again.
They're bringing in five substitutes. I think they're also going to bring in, you can make five substitutes, but they're also going to have nine on the bench. And Villa have been voting against this. I think four teams voted against the idea of having nine subs on the bench. And that's mainly because the bigger teams with the established Premier League teams with bigger squads obviously have more depth to cope for the fixture list, which comes in fast and furious. And Villa's, as we know, when you look on that bench, there's not really much on it to impact games. So we're at potential weakness there for Villa. That's why I think these early games, we've got to get a decent haul of points.
Yeah, just get a bit of momentum as well.
Also, the Women's League was suspended. Villa were top, 14 games, 13 wins, 1 draw, 6 points clear of Sheffield United in second. The only real debate was when Graham Souness said about, the entitlement of it was incredible. How Liverpool women's team should stay in the top tier of women's football. It would be good for women's football. If they want to get themselves on the map, then Liverpool should be in there for the prestige. Just basically for marketing.
Yeah, overlooking the fact that they're bottom.
Because they've been getting pumped every week in front of one man and a dog. Yeah. Great.
Hang on, this sounds like a league I need to see. I'm happy for Sky to unpause my subscription immediately.
Chris, Bird, what have you said?
It's a tsunami of filth.
At the same time, you could argue that Aston Villa actually started the Football League, so they really should stay in the Premier League, the men's team we're talking about, because it would be to the detriment of the league if they were relegated.
Nobody wants to watch Bournemouth.
Exactly. So, Souness's logic should apply to Villa, men's team. But what's happened is Liverpool have dropped. They're replaced by Villa. Happy days, the women's team can actually kick on now with a bit more exposure in the top league. The only thing else related to the Women's League we actually didn't mention last time was Eni Aluko's comments about furloughing, where she insinuated that, I think it was just a reaction to a couple of one or two tweets she saw where somebody was celebrating getting an extension of furloughing. And she was referring to that. And if you do anything wrong, you get completely lynched. And the internet attacked her big time. And all she was really guilty of was thinking out aloud on Twitter, which is never wise to do.
It's dangerous. And I think that my view was that you don't touch those topics on social media, do you? That especially you don't wade in with a blanket statement that furlough is creating a culture of do nothing entitlement, because you haven't got that space to have a proper debate, have you? And it's
exactly
that snapshot, you know, resulted in, I think she had to put her profile as private, maybe, or
I think she's just thought, fuck this. I mean, she, you know, apologized and everything. And it's kind of funny how some people can do serious things, apologize. Like Grealish puts his video, apologize. And the next day, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry saying, oh, he apologized. What more do you want him to say? And it's like, it's almost under, you know, brushed under the carpet. When she apologizes, I don't know if it's because she's a woman, because she's black. That apparently it's not good enough to apologize. It's kind of, it's funny watching how it, you know, the dynamic of things and how they work for some people and not for others.
It's not like she didn't share an opinion that's probably shared by quite a few people.
Yeah, and she was triggered by a certain tweet that she'd seen, and that's what she was, and what she didn't really do is refine her tweet, and it was, as Dan said, that's, it was more point. Of a blanket statement. Yeah, but you know, she's a smart cookie, and you live and learn. Right, let's move on to the 3 points now. Point number one, just quickly, for the first time, the Premier League have recorded 0 cases in the last round of COVID tests. The Championship, out of 1,179 tests, only recorded 2. So there seems to be a bit of progress there, and it seems to be in line of what's happening in the rest of the country, with no reported tests in, I think, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Point number two, the Newcastle takeover, the Saudi sovereign wealth takeover, which we've mentioned before, that they're looking for an 80% stake in the Toon Army, which seems to be in, let's say, uncertain waters, when the World Trade Organization has ruled that the Saudis are indeed behind the pirate satellite TV.
But they must listen to this podcast. We warned them of this months ago.
Streaming service. We did flag it, and they have listened.
They haven't offered us the money.
I mean... Oh,
great. I mean, if the Saudis had trumped up a big sponsorship, and you know, we could have taken hush money there, but you missed out on that opportunity. So we forwarded a file of the podcast onto the World Trade Organization, and hey presto, they created a 130-page report on the matter.
They were thorough. I'll give them that.
Which will be published in mid-June. So this is an interesting situation, because the Premier League, along with FIFA, UEFA, La Liga, and others, have tried to take legal action against this channel. Who is it? It's BeOutQ?
BeOutQ.
BeOutQ. It's nothing to do with Andy Gray, is it? Is that another one?
He's running it from his bedroom.
Oh, they're in Qatar, aren't they?
Yes. Arch enemies of Saudi Arabia.
Arch enemies. And they've been trying to, understandably so, because at least they pay for the rights of the Premier League. So this has been happening in the background. They've been trying to sue these dudes. So I wouldn't know anything about this, but if you were looking at illegal streams and ones came up in Arabic, it's probably this channel, is it not?
Yeah.
High possibility, yeah.
So this is, if there's one big stickler, I mean, the Premier League is fundamentally built on TV rights. So this is something they will take pretty seriously. But at the same time, because they like money, I think they can be persuaded. So I don't have total conviction that they would stick to their guns and their principles and tell them to get lost if the Saudis gave them a sweetener, so to speak. But we will see. Meanwhile, I think just after the last podcast came out, Mr. Bruce was getting very excited, and he said he'd love it, this takeover to happen, and he'd love to be part of it and compete against the big boys. But what he failed to realise is, I think if somebody's going to spend that much money acquiring a football club, they'll probably bin him straight away.
Well, the Saudis have got previous on that.
Yeah, it won't be like nice Aston Villa where they let him stay for a few months to try to prove himself. It'll be an instant execution, I feel. Oops, sorry. I didn't mean it literally.
Would you like to come to the embassy, Mr. Bruce?
Oh, Christ.
Are we leaving that in?
In walks Steve Bruce, out walks... What are all these sausages?
This will taste great with cabbage.
Oh, God.
Right, point number three. We'll leave that in. This is why you listen to this show, I suppose. Point number three. If there's never another My Old Man Said show, you probably second guess why.
We've taken the money and run.
No, we've all been bloody disappeared, more likely.
Yeah, not money, Mr. Bud. It's cheaper to get rid of us. Hmm. Point number three is the FA they're in constant meetings in terms of how to clean up the shit show that is.
So they're creating a whole new area of controversy.
I mean, I can't say too much because they're behind closed doors conversations. That I've only just seen like kind of notes and whatever from. But they're definitely looking at a worst case scenario of there being no fans for the whole season. I mean, I've seen in some press talking about no fans up to November. But I think it's wise to plan worst case scenario and say, right, next season, no fans. And but then if you suddenly, you know, let's say the government restrictions free up even more and there is the potential to have fans, does that suddenly compromise the integrity of the competition if suddenly some people have been playing home games with no fans and then suddenly other teams will have the benefit of having fans there? Well, we shall see.
Especially if you get regional lockdowns or regional variation on social distancing relaxation.
Yeah, which is a distinct possibility. Just keep the lockdown in Newcastle for the next four seasons. So the Saudis can't make any money. From gate receipts, anyway.
Well, they won't make any money at Newcastle.
And also, it looks like there's going to be a change to the handball rule in terms of a goal will only be chalked off if the handball was immediately before it. So we're talking about if somebody's down the wing and he accidentally handballs it and it's a few seconds before an actual goal, then I don't think that's going to be given.
Not sure about that one.
But we don't know about that one. And then you've got the position of what is handball. So I think the distinction is going to be, is it still, I think this is how it is now, is it not? It's where the shoulder ends and the arm starts, which is essentially the bottom of the armpit, which I think is something that's in play at the moment, is it not?
I forget the game. What was the game where Tyrone Mings got sent off for handball and it hit him on the angle of his shoulder? That would not be handball.
That would not be handball under the definition of where the shoulder ends and the arm starts at the bottom of the armpit. But anyway, this is a conversation. I'm sure there'll be a conversation for the future. Right, before we go on, I just want to give a big shout out to the new My Old Man Said patrons that have joined the club. Thank you very much to Adam Blair, Matthew Allen, Leo Bryan, Colin McKay and Mickey McCarville. Thank you very much for joining up. And also to George Jones and Harvey Farmer for upping their pledges as well. If you also want to become a patron and get access to extra shows, at the moment there's a three-part serialization of an interview I did with Sean Teal once upon a time. Part one is already out now. No sitting on the fence with Mr. Teal. There's some explosive stuff already.
And he's a very funny guy.
So it's good stuff that you don't get from, you know, today's players.
Well, it's someone with a bit of personality. What a novelty.
And nothing to lose as well. So, yeah, check in for that. But also another benefit, a new benefit, probably the biggest benefit potentially, is we have created something called Match Club. Unfortunately, the first rule of it's the second rule as well of Match Club is you can't really talk about Match Club. Only patrons will know what Match Club is. Should we give them any clues or?
One.
No, maybe next episode.
Time.
Yeah, next time. Okay, one clue is it's to do with the remaining 10 games of the season, and it's hopefully will counteract the non-event Ghost Stadium blandness. We shall see. Worth signing up just for that. But patrons, existing patrons, I will be dropping you a line soon about Match Club and more details of how to get ready, because we'll be running ad hoc tests throughout the next week or so. So, yeah, please do, if you want to be a My Old Man Said patron and support the show also, as well as getting extra shows and access to Match Club, go to myoldmansaid.com and check out the patron link and go from there. If you're on a mobile device, you have to click on the menu, those three bars in the top left-hand side, and that will give you access to a menu where patrons is an option. Oh yeah, and by the way, if you want to just support the show in a one-off way, Acast, that hosts the podcast, have now included an option for listeners where they can make a donation to support the show. There's actually a link in the notes to support the show, or go to acast.com/myoldmansaid and you will see it there. It's just another option if you just wanted to do a one-off tip in pounds. Thanks. Every little helps at this stage. Right, on to the main topic. So there was an article that came out, Why Empty Grounds Are the Perfect Stage for Players That Only Do It in Training. And this is a phenomenon that people have spoken about for years. I always remember Alex Ferguson referencing players that he signed had to actually be able to play for Manchester United and play in a full Old Trafford and meet the expectation, because some players haven't got the mentality to do that. So one of the My Old Man Said patrons, Gary Horgan, had a very good idea, very rightly mentioned this to me via email. And the reason he brought this up to me was, of course, in relation to Dean Smith's comments after that 2-0 away defeat to Southampton. I think that was Villa's ninth loss in 13 games, where we started to get a bit twitchy. And you know, he said after that game, will we get that performance again? I certainly hope not. Well, Leicester City.
I got pumped to use Chris Budd's terminology.
The players will be fairly embarrassed when they drive home as well. There's too many training ground players. You have to perform on a match day. If you want to be a Premier League player, you have to perform week in, week out. Too many of ours didn't today. I mean, I mentioned Leicester as a joke. I mean, you can put that down. If you want to make excuses, you can put that down to, you know, after the Lord Mayor's show at Wembley in the League Cup final, you know, disappointment, players down and, you know, ripe for the picking. Also, if you pick a completely different system to the one that was successful against Leicester in the previous encounters when we did well against them, then you're asking for trouble. If you pick the same kind of lineup as when you got pumped previously by, you know, four goals, then pretty predictable. This Athletic article starts off with a quote from Luis Enrique saying, playing without fans is sadder than dancing with your sister. We're looking at the reverse of that, where there actually could be benefits here. Because if we've got training ground players, or too many training ground players, the situation is empty stadiums are like a training ground. So the upshot is, will this be an advantage, do you think? People have asked questions like this before on this to this podcast, saying, does the negativity get to the younger players or the ones that have just signed? Does that work against us when, you know, we perhaps aren't as patient with players as we should be? So this takes away all of that. And so the players can just go out there and express themselves.
Or would it run the risk of creating the sanitised training ground experience that you see with under 23 football, where it looks like football, but it lacks that. And players must, and you know, there's enough biographies that say that they respond to the, you know, the running towards a halt end that's baying for you to play that cutting pass or run on. That's got to be part of it.
For example, is that quote? Did Chris flag this last couple of podcasts? I can't remember. Grealish says, you know, Anwar El Ghazi in training is sensational at finishing.
Mm.
Now, I mean, he's pretty good in the playoff final, and you know, he was a constant menace. But we've seen it. He flitters hot and cold. But here's Grealish saying this man stands out. He's at another level in training.
Well, El Ghazi is clearly technically very good. I'm not sure if he's a training ground player. I just think he's very, very inconsistent. That would be my observation of him. Are we talking about confidence players here?
Yeah, this is what we're talking about, because Grealish is saying in training his finishing is unreal.
Mm.
So you're saying he's an inconsistent player, but what Grealish is saying in training, he's not.
Yeah, but Grealish wears two flip-flops on the side of the road in
Yeah, no, but seriously, Dean Smith, he's saying the same thing. Have we got too many training ground players? And Douglas Luiz does look like somebody who's probably amazing in training. And when it peps up and, the, you know, you've got the crowd on your back, you get the ball, and he's expecting a lot more time than he actually gets because the atmosphere is on top of him. You can see, I mean, he's top of the list of Villa players that it would apply to, if you ask me. Chris, what do you think about this notion?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of someone like an Algarve.
Because Dan obviously doesn't get it.
No, I just don't believe in it. I just don't believe in it. I'm going to throw this in. I think that that was an excuse from Dean Smith when he said that. And I think that's these guys are at the professional, at the elite of their profession. I can see how like players' heads can drop and you see with strikers and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I don't buy it. I think for me...
I disagree, but sorry, Chris.
I buy some of it. I mean, I look at someone, say, to use the Algarve example. You know, looks great in training, great finisher, blah, blah, blah. You think, well, hang on a minute. Who's he been playing against in professional matches and who's he been training against in terms of the back four?
It's like he's excellent
been,
point.
He's been training against one of the worst back fours in the league day in, day out. Yeah. So, of course, he's going to get opportunities to score.
Yeah.
That would be my one point.
So that's a point very well made.
The other, unfortunately, it doesn't reflect well on Dean Smith at all to me.
No.
Because I think, well, okay, if you can get your players doing it on the training ground, the reason that they're not doing it on a match day is ultimately the buck stops at you. You know, it's your responsibility. Is it a tactical thing? Maybe. Is it a man management thing? It could well be that. It will be, the reality is it will be multiple factors. Certainly the thing of when things start to go wrong, or especially in games, for example, if you had a game that you had to win and when Villa don't show urgency, you know, you're getting this, you know, where Villa need to chase a game and they're kind of fucking around with the ball and just tick-attacker nonsense. That's always been a bit of a problem, hasn't it?
got no time for passing, hey bud.
Well, I think it's the lack of intent, isn't it? I mean, I'll happily watch Villa play patient football and if there's some intent, but it's the lack of intent that you see sometimes.
To be honest, I think you're being a little bit harsh when you compare it to like the Lambert years, for example.
That's what I mean.
And McLeish, for example. I mean, it's you can't really accuse these guys that, you know, of that kind of level.
That's what I mean with the support, in terms of having the supporters, those are some of the things that get the supporters sort of riled up.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly, you know, if someone bottles a tackle, you know, right in front of the touchline, right in front of the Holt end, for example, people are going to shout and scream. You know, if they're playing for an empty stadium, it's like, yeah, the interesting thing will be all of a sudden you'll be able to hear the communication of the players on the field. That's going to be an interesting thing for the broadcasters to have to censor out the sheer quantity of swearing.
Now, we'll all have our apps and we'll be shouting obscenities through, won't we?
That's of course, yeah.
Through my cardboard cutout or your
LED
sex doll.
My LED face.
Borussia Mönchengladbach, just on a segue quickly, had 13,000 cardboard cutouts at 19 euros each. And to be honest, it looked actually good. I mean, I said on social media, it wasn't even meant to be an intended pun, but I said it looked better than it sounded.
Yeah.
And I was talking about the idea, but it actually worked as a joke.
The big thing for me with the difference for an empty stadium versus having, especially a home crowd, is the thing of momentum. You know, I remember, for example, like the previous season when we were 3-0 down to Sheffield United with, 10 minutes to play. The first one goes in and everyone's like, yeah, whatever. The second one goes in and all of a sudden...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Everyone,
as well.
All of a sudden the atmosphere changes. You know, at 3-1, everyone's like, oh, okay, maybe. We'll give it a go. At 3-2, everyone's like, right, how long's left? Right, game on. And then the board goes.
I think
that
you're talking about those galvanising moments, aren't they?
And it's these little moments. I mean, I've said this numerous times, and I don't know why it does come to mind. But I remember like that first year we got relegated, and we had that appalling derby against Blues. Gabby got subbed on, and all of a sudden, the crowd were like, "Oh, hang on a minute!" And I remember the first 5 minutes, he smashed a Blues player into the stand, and everyone was like, and everyone just lifted. It was like a dreadful tackle. Has all of a sudden changed the context of this game. The same as, you know, you see like, you saw it on numerous occasions before when you'd get like, Villa would be floundering in possession. McGinn would just pick the ball up and drive. And all of a sudden the crowd are lifted. And that, I think that does make a difference. That's that thing, if you can gain momentum, you can also lose momentum.
But that's talking about the impact of the crowds per se. We're talking about training ground players. So you could say that we wouldn't need the kind of inspiration of the crowd because we'll already be 3-0 up because we have these incredible training ground players.
Maybe. I just think in an empty stadium.
I think McGinn surely is a better player with a crowd. I'd say Grealish responds to the occasion and he responds well to pressure.
Well, it's the performance aspect for him. I think with all those type of players, they want to, I hate to use the word, express themselves, but you know what I mean.
Well, you saw that with the Blues derby last season at St Andrews, didn't you? That there was that crazy moment where that fan gets on the pitch, and after that, to be composed and to score the goal that he did. I think that, you know, I'm not saying that moment with the fan was what caused that, but there is something in it. I think that you take away that fan input, and that's a big part of the atmosphere and the motivation and the
word's intensity, isn't it? It's the lack of intensity.
I was about to say, I think, and I don't know if they can monitor this. Maybe they can because they monitor how many miles players run, et cetera, every game. But I think players will run faster with a crowd there. Chris said, it's more intense. So I think that favours players like El Ghazi and Luiz because it's not as intense. It's not in your face. Now, Luiz, if a game's not in your face as much, then I think he's got that time and suddenly becomes a much more dangerous player.
The big thing that very few have, and I haven't even seen the press talk about this, and it's literally just popped into my mind, so I am relatively thinking out loud, but one advantage that those players that you've mentioned will have over both our players and a lot of other ones, and some clubs will have guys in the same boat, is that El Ghazi, El Mohammadi, Trezeguet are all from North African nations who are used to the heat. You know, they're going to be playing games in June and July. You know, the likes of John McGinn is not used to it above about 10 degrees.
He's not seen the sun, has he?
Yeah. You know, and these are guys, very few in our squad will have played, you know, elite level tournament football, which is in the summer. So they won't be used to the sort of the shifting dynamics in how the game works, and that someone like a McGinn in, you know, a 25, 30 degree heat cannot play the way he wants to play because he'll just be knackered after the first half. You know, whereas the guys who are used to the heat, you know, someone like a Luiz who's used to heat and humidity in South America, he's played in Spain in the heat, you know, El Ghazi.
How hot does it get in this country?
It makes a difference, though.
You know, 16 degrees.
Well, I'm looking forward to this summer.
Yeah, well, you look at the last game I went to at Wembley, I had multiple layers on, and it was sub 10 degrees. I'm sure at least all of a sudden, you know, you're into sort of pre-season friendly temperatures, and you've seen the lack of intensity.
Oh, we've all
tempo.
Been there at the Bescot sweltering.
Yeah.
wishing we weren't there.
It always seems like a good idea when you buy the ticket.
And for a split second when you close your eyes, you think, oh, I'm on Bondi Beach. And then you open your eyes and realise you're on an industrial estate in Bescot.
Delicious Warsaw Wurst.
Yeah. If you can even get to the one food stand in the corner. But you get my point that I think that the heat will have a huge impact as another factor in pulling the intensity down. These games are going to be shit games of football.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
I think they will, especially any...
he's a killjoy, this Chris Budd, isn't he?
And I'll tell you why, because of the situation we find ourselves in.
Don't pause your Sky subscription, just cancel them.
I don't have one. Never bothered.
Neither do I. Neither do I.
I watch Saudi Arabian pirate TV.
I look at some of the teams and their situations, for example, like I'll use Liverpool. I think they're two wins away from securing the league. They could get those two wins and Klopp could take the stance of, well, we're not going to get to defend the Champions League, so that's gone. Like, this is what we're playing for, is the next two games. They put all their eggs in one basket for those two games. Then when they've actually achieved it, he's thinking, well, do you know what? This isn't worth any taking any risks. I'm not going to force you to play.
I think, you're going to get situations where players will say, Gaffer's all right,
they'll
if I step down.
They'll just down tools.
And that will go with mid-table teams. So, I mean, I'm just going to say one more thing on this training ground player thing. I mean, I don't play FIFA or any of that stuff, but, I mean, come on, FIFA 2021 or 2022, if you could insert this is a shout out to the developers of FIFA, if you could insert
EA
a training
Sports
ground
in the game
if you could introduce a training ground player rating, so we actually know, you know, if they're going to be any good as training ground players in these fanless stadiums, that would be much appreciated. Henry Lansbury, 100.
Oh, he's he definitely is.
If the first game we're playing, Henry Lansbury is suddenly the captain, and he's in the team and the captain, then you're going to realise that, oh, there is something to do with this training ground player. let's just branch this off into advantages in general for what is essentially a reset of this, of, you know, it's starting again. Smith said, you know, Villa would always be good, you know, better in his second season, and he's trying to make out that this is like akin to a second season. And I can see some logic in that, because you know, they're starting with no momentum, and you know you're starting afresh again, and you know what it is like at the start of a season. It's open house a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. But as Chris was saying there, certain teams, when they've achieved their objectives, will slack off, as they always do. But in this case, because there's this the cloud of COVID, they can say, well, can I not play? You know, we've done the job. We're in Europe. We've escaped. You know, we're mid-table, or we've won the league. So Villa have got a motivation. They've got a reason to play these games. So in terms of the factor of, in terms of advantage of motivation, and we've flagged so many times those, you know, miracle relegation escapes, because those teams have an objective. And when you're playing against teams that not only are what's the catchphrase, on the beach already, you know, they've gone back into isolation, this is a major advantage for Villa. I think McGinn will be biting at the bit coming back. It's almost like he's born again, because he thought he'd have played, because he wouldn't have played probably half of the games that he's going to play now, because he wouldn't have been totally match fit.
Yeah, that's true.
John McGinn is another advantage, but I think from a standing still start, and Villa have actually got a mission, I wouldn't be surprised, I'm not saying it's going to happen, that we actually do pretty well in those games. I just want to be optimistic for 1 minute.
Now, there are a few I have various...
Now, here he comes again.
Here he comes. It's like the fucking...
Bang is prophet of doom. Boom, boom.
Not at all, actually. I'm the prophet of...
B-52 bombing squad alert. Here they come.
It's going to be napalm. One thing is that Dean Smith probably in his management career, certainly in his time at Villa, he won't have ever had this much time to take stock tactically, because he will be very aware that both him and his team have made mistakes. And you'd like to think he'll have identified them. Now, whether he's learnt from them, that's going to be to be decided.
Oh, this is Aston Villa. We'll make a whole new load of new mistakes.
Yeah, we'll find a way. The other one will be the sort of the intensity that the players potentially, as you said, are at, because some teams might not be at it and some will. You know, you look at our fixtures, and it makes me glad that actually we don't have lots of games against the teams around us, because they're the ones who are going to be fighting. Because once Liverpool have won the league, I think Man City are virtually mathematically there as well.
Yeah.
We've already played Leicester. They're going to be fighting. The tough ones become sort of United. You know, anyone who's just close to top four.
Mm-hmm.
But other games, you know, you're looking at sort of Sheffield United. Well, if Man U have a good run, Chelsea have a good run, Wolves, they're all better sides than Sheffield. And I think of all the teams in the league, I think when we didn't know how long the break, this, you know, this period was going to last, but a break in the season couldn't have suited a much better time, because we were free falling.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like we'd sort of, you take the cup final out of the equation, but it wasn't like we'd had a little mini upturn. You think, oh, do you know what? We're looking all right here. You know, we'd finally dropped into the bottom three.
Because I mentioned, even at that point of Southampton, when the training ground players quote came out, we'd lost 9 out of 13 games, and they didn't really improve much on that. As I've said a few times, we have, though, within the season already demonstrated a good spectrum of ability. And the good bit is we've been up there in against good teams, but we haven't had the courage of our convictions at times. Arsenal, Liverpool, for example.
Mm.
And other times it's just been mistakes, like the first game against Spurs, and then numerous other games.
Bournemouth sticks in my mind.
Burnley, very naive. We let them come back into it.
The lack of not beating West Ham was really one that grated on me. The West Ham home game where we played 10,
clueless 10-men games.
Yeah. Mm.
Clueless against 10 men. But we have demonstrated, because you know people have been slagging off the squad, and as you got to remember, there's a lot of young guys in there who were bought for their potential as much of what they could do in their first season. Now, of course, there's the argument, and it's a very valid argument, that we should have bought at least two more experienced out of the box Premier League players. There's no doubt about that. But is, you know, this they'd have had, they also, like Dean Smith, would have had a chance to take stock and learn, and it would be like a mini first season, and they're only going to get better in a second season. So with that long break, and footballers don't have breaks this long, there is a hope that they can gravitate to the good end of that spectrum of ability that they've actually shown and produce the good. But I mean, essentially all they have to do is cut out stupid mistakes and they should be all right.
Yeah, I actually think the experience argument, it kind of helps Villa in a way, because this period we're in, there isn't a footballer in the world who's experienced this. We are playing matches in uncharted territory. So it's kind of like everyone's, you know, there'll be very few players who've had this short a break. So we're at the point where actually they'll be quite sort of, not lethargic, but they won't be match fit, will they?
No, exactly.
Yeah, and the thing that, well, very few of these players will be used to playing a game completely behind closed doors regularly. You know, some of the Champions League players might have experienced it on a one-off occasion, but to play big games, like, you know, really important matches without the crowd will be...
Well, multiple games as well. Yeah, you know, they're going to face that's the prospect of it returning to as it was is slow.
Yeah.
Does this play into the hands of teams like Bournemouth, who have been playing in front of hardly any crowds anyway, at home anyway, so...
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
I mean, this. I think another key thing, and I don't know how you quantify this, is to how do you get players mentally prepared, and is there an advantage to be gained by that somehow? But I mean, I don't know how you quantify that because obviously we are in uncharted waters.
It's the guys who can laser focus and sort of just go, we're just going to play our game. You know, it's that cliche, you know, you play the opposition rather than the occasion, which is probably easier in an empty stadium because the crowd factor just doesn't come into it for anyone. So whether that's a leveller for some teams and isn't for others, you know, like places like St James's Park, you know, notoriously, if you get the crowd quiet in the first 20 minutes, it becomes an easy ground to play at. If the crowd get on top of you quickly, it becomes a hard ground to play at. I think Villa Park's quite similar.
Yeah, it's interestingly, it takes you back to when you were playing, Sunday League games where there is that intensity still, and I think it brings you closer together as a group of players, so hopefully they're all buddies and they get on, because that will be a big thing, because it does all you can hear is your teammates at the end of the day, because you know, it's back in those days, you know, playing as a kid is, you know, you maybe you got a parent standing on the sidelines, there's a dog there, and that's it. It's you are laser focused in the game, there's no real distractions, it's just your teammates really.
And absolutely, and I think Smith and the players will know that they have to turn up for 10 games. It is a 10-game season now. We're not talking about 38 games and, oh, we've got to sustain this level for the next, you know, 8 to 10 months. This is, Smith will probably say, I need 6 weeks of good work out of you here.
As long as nobody says, oh, it's 10 FA Cup finals. I can't stand that cliche. Right, moving on. Let's move on. Let's move on to underrated or overrated. Right, this is the part of the show where we take a trio of ex-Villa players from the borderline of those two definitions to eccentric characters that just because we have some fondness for them, we might give them a bit of love. Right, from the first one up this episode, I think I dropped his name in the last show, Mustafa Hadji. All I can remember about him is, was it the 98 World Cup? Where that Moroccan team was dynamite. As North African teams tend to be a very, very tidy. And if you've got a couple of top draw men, sometimes like you know, your Egypts, your Algerias, your Moroccos, very, very tasty going forward. Not so great in defence. But when they've got a couple of star players, and they did have their talisman was Hadji in that 98 World Cup. And the first game against Norway, he scored.
It's a lovely pass from Taha, and plenty of space here for Hadji. Oh, great goal for Morocco! Dan Egan came across, but the sleight of foot from Hadji beat him, and then the shot sped past Grodas.
And Norway was shocked because, you know, it's typical European superiority complex. You always look at African teams as cannon fodder.
Mm-hmm.
But in recent tournaments, obviously, they've got better and better and better. Although after, I think it's Cameroon and Nigeria, the Super Eagles had a decent team like in the 90s. You expected somebody to really, I think Ghana did well though, didn't they? Is it in South Africa World Cup?
Yeah, and Ivory Coast have got better.
But they've never really stamped their authority and got into a final yet. But anyway, we digress. But Hadji lit up that tournament. In the last game, they beat Scotland 3-0. But all they had to do is beat Scotland. They did it. And it was like, because Norway had to play Brazil. And with 7 minutes to go, Brazil are 1-0 up. It's like, you know, this is like business as usual. And somehow Norway scored two goals in the last 7 minutes and beat Brazil and pipped Morocco into the next round. And because of that World Cup, Hadji, you know, typical process, players have a good World Cup, get picked up by Premier League teams. Did he go straight to Coventry?
He was at Deportivo. I think he went the year after, so he would have maybe had another year in Spain, and then he went to Coventry in 99.
But he was a bit player in Deportivo. I mean, he wasn't like a super regular.
No.
But I just like Hadji from the World Cup. So when he had a reasonably decent time at Coventry, I think he was there for a couple of seasons, Villa picked him up under John Gregory, and he thought, I think you just thought, is it a bit extra for the squad here? A bit of a potential diamond for us. But I mean, what were your, have you got any memories of Mr. Hadji?
One of my favourite ones is actually, of one of my more favourite Villa games actually, was the last game of the season when he scored an absolute worldie at the Holt End, then scored a header, and he put Coventry 2-0 up at half-time. And you know that was the game when they had to win to stay up. And then, of course, Merson scored that last-minute wonder goal to put them down. Yeah. I think that was his last game for Coventry.
Yeah, Juan Pablo Angel's first goal for Villa as well.
Because I think he was there was a bit of controversy before that game because I think Morocco were trying to get him out of there. What year was that? It must have been for another World Cup.
2001, I think it was.
It might have been for like an African Nations or something. But I know they were trying to get him out, but Coventry were fighting because they needed him for that game because they had to win it, you know, to have any chance of staying up. He only scored two goals for Villa.
I remember them both, David. He scored one, a header at Southampton.
That's
in his first season.
What was the score on
that? We won that one 3-1. Another rare goal scorer was George Boateng that night.
Wow. It was the NTL shirt.
Yeah, the pink NTL shirt. And weirdly, the other one, from what I remember, I'm sure he scored in the UEFA Cup when we got knocked out by NK Vartex.
He did.
And it was a great goal.
There's a rule of thumb when you buy, let's say, a continental player, or they used to be when it wasn't so common, it was always better to buy them in twos because it helps them settle down. And we obviously got Hasan Kaşlı as well. Another legend.
Yes.
But he had his moments, did he not?
Well, another tidy player, wasn't he? But they'd both come from poor sides, and where Villa were aspiring to be was not where Southampton and Coventry, with all due respect to them, were.
I think a player like Hadji now, I mean, he was African Player of the Year as well, if memory serves me right. If a player like Hadji now, he with the greatest respect to Coventry City and their equivalents today, he doesn't go. That's not the move that he makes. I think that.
Yeah. When you got that kind of hairstyle, though, you know, you've got to get what you can get.
There's stylists, we can work on that. But I think he had supreme amount of talent. There's one other thing I do remember, and I don't know whether this is folklore or not, but he got to the end of his Villa career and he was on something like 49 games. And it was at a time when we were stuttering in the league. And I don't think he ever made that appearance because it would have triggered a payment to Coventry for...
I remember this, yeah.
And I just remember looking at the team sheet one day and seeing that we'd opted to pick Øyvind Leonardsen instead of Hadji and thinking, yes, something is truly amiss in the world at the moment. My memory is...
Well, I think this goes back to the 98 World Cup when Norway conned their way in match fixing.
It's always the Norwegians,
past Brazil.
My experience.
Hadji's got some bad, bad memories of Norway. I don't think he ever visited there on holiday. Who can blame him?
No. So what we're saying, underrated or overrated?
Oh, yeah, forget about the premise of this section. He's one of these players that, in my heart, I wanted him to be great.
Mm.
And I've got to say, overrated. He could only play well against Norway, apparently.
And against Villa.
And against Villa, yeah.
I'd go overrated just for the fact that, like so many players, we bought him off the back of one half-decent season.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, that would be the same. He was overrated.
Right, let's go to the second one, Mr. Earl Barrett. Now, Mr. Earl Barrett, and I mean, I was thinking about him earlier on when I was listening to this Sean Teal interview that I did, and we were talking about Earl Barrett. And I think I mentioned on the show before that there was, back in those Ron Atkinson days, there was one player that I really wanted. If I could have anybody on my top of my list was Dean Saunders, and suddenly Villa bought him, and it was like, wow. And it also, I remember watching Oldham versus Manchester United in the FA Cup semi-final. It's probably the best day of neutral football ever, was when there was back-to-back semi-finals. 3-3 Manchester United and Oldham, and 4-3 Palace win over Liverpool. And Earl Barrett was immense. He just marked Mark Hughes out of the game. I don't think any of their forwards scored that day, even though they scored three goals. And he was incredible, this Earl Barrett. And I thought, you know, if we ever got, you know, if we get Earl Barrett, it'd be great. And we did. He scored the opening goal in that 3-3 game. He didn't score many goals for Villa, though, did he,
no.
Old Earl? And so you're thinking about Earl Barrett at centre-back, but you've got this situation where you've got Teal and McGrath, and you're thinking, is this Villa like stockpiling, you know, the best talent? Because I was thinking, this is great. You know, mm-hmm. We've got Teal, McGrath, and an Earl Barrett now. But then you think, hey, how's Earl going to get a game if the preferred combo is Teal and McGrath? And then suddenly Earl Barrett is playing right back. And at times he wasn't the most graceful right backs. And we were in that situation in the 90s and through to the early noughties where we never had a proper right back, you know. Most of the time, it was a centre-back playing right back.
Some would say never, David.
I mean, you go Qualis Quayle, you go Aleph Melberg. Earl Barrett was like this first of the generation of centre-backs playing in it. It's all right when you're defending corners because you've got an extra big man, extra centre-back in essence. But once he's over the halfway line, then that's where the problem kicks in.
It's classic Villa, isn't it? Seeing a player quality in a player's quality in their position. And, you know, it was a couple of podcasts ago we talked about Rio Coca, that we bought a box to box exciting English midfielder and turned him into a right back conveniently.
Yeah, I remember that time because that was like, all right, this centre back at right back's not working. What about Rio Coca? Now, this could be. We refuse to buy a right back. Maybe the changing Rio Coca into one will be the solution. But I mean, testament to Earl Barrett, this was not his chosen position, yet he managed to get into the England squad as a right back. I don't know if that says more about the state of English football at the time or what.
I mean, the fact that he had Tony DiRigo and Lee Dixon ahead of him in the pecking order would suggest that not exactly England's greatest era, was it? This was the do I not like that Graham Taylor era?
Carlton Palmer territory.
Yeah, I mean,
Dixon was a very good professional.
He was part of the Invincibles and a good Arsenal team. So
I think Earl Barrett was very much, like so many at that time, was a player of that era. in terms of, you know, you look at what a fullback is or has to be now. You know, they're normally incredibly dynamic. They're probably two of the fittest players on the field. They have to be an attacking threat.
His strength was, and what got him through being out of position, essentially, was he was so athletic.
Yeah.
Mm.
And speaking to Sean Teal about it, he said originally, because of Paul McGrath's knees, they still needed, whoever partnered McGrath, they needed a centre-back who would attack the ball because, you know, McGrath's more of a reader. He's not diving in and his, you know, knees are fucked. So that's why Teal essentially got the nod, because Barrett was a bit more, let's say, of a McGrath figure, but, and, you know, very good in recovery and had the athleticism. But he made an interesting point. He said when Aston Villa played Arsenal, Ron Atkinson would always play Earl Barrett a centre-back to man-mark Ian Wright, and he followed Ian Wright everywhere. And he said, you know, if Ian Wright was selected at left-back for Arsenal, Earl Barrett would be playing right wing, essentially, because he was just told to follow Ian Wright everywhere. And that was the switch they made, and Teal would go to left-back, and there'd be this kind of shift around, and Earl Barrett would be alongside McGrath in the centre-back position at man-marking Ian Wright, because he had the speed and athleticism. And as Teal said, Ian Wright hardly got a kick of the ball when he played against Earl Barrett.
No.
This is something that was frustrating, because I thought, well, surely... But sometimes when he played centre-back, he didn't have his greatest game if there was an injury or something. But I was always frustrated because that ingrained on me watching him against Manchester United in those games. And I just thought if he was, you know, alongside McGrath, would be dynamic. But obviously you're taking away Sean Teal there.
I mean, I remember the 94 Cup final, you know, he'd have come up against, at the time, you know, Dennis Irwin, who was probably one of the top fullbacks in England at that point. And of course, a young Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
And he had a superb game. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and I think he was ever present that first Premier League season when he scored his solitary goal, which was actually a really tasty lob against Everton.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't that sort of, you know, your Trent Alexander-Arnold type right back, you know, who's going to bomb on, get to the byline and whip a crossing or have it distribute. But it was more of it was in the era of flat back fours of, you know, you'd have four solid defensive players. It just so happened that we actually would have Steve Staunton at left back, who could get forward and was a goal threat and had an unbelievable shot on him.
Mm-hmm.
I'd imagine Staunton was a relative anomaly, but Earl Barrett wasn't, you know, he was more of a, I'll take their left winger out of the game, as opposed to, I'm going to pin their fullback.
I mean, he was a centre-back, essentially. So defensively, I mean, defensively was very good. It was almost like you had to play him because he was a player so good that he was better than whatever right-back you had, so to speak, that it was worth putting in his place. Mm. Defensively, you got so much from it that it was worth, I forgot who were the right-back equivalent. I mean, you had like Neil Cox, who would play there. And, you know, really, there's no argument, is there?
No.
The Earl of Barrett, how are we rating him?
I'm going to say Earl Barrett was underrated.
Yeah, I'm going to say underrated because he was actually not playing in his main position and he did a decent job playing out of position, essentially. And he made that his position.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to say very unfashionably underrated. He just went about his work, didn't he? It's that cliche, did a job.
Well, to round off my view, I'd say that what you were talking about, you know, you mentioned Dennis Irwin, and I was just thinking of other fullbacks of that era. And this is the back end of the 80s into the early 90s of, you like you said, the Irwins, the Paul Parkers. You know, I'm just thinking of some of the other teams that, you know, Dixon, they were good at their jobs.
Yeah, Winterburn, you know, Stig Bjornaby at Liverpool, players like that.
But I'm thinking that he was, and the clue is that Ron Atkinson would put him up against Ian Wright, who was like pace, power, everything. I think he was more of a modern day centre-back who would have been better off in today's game than then in terms of being athletic and being able to deal with these like faster centre-forwards. As we've gone on, we've got increasingly away from that standard, you know, big number nine kind of routine where you needed your Sean Teals, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Barrett would be a better centre-back in today's game as opposed to then, even though that was the thing, he didn't really get his chance at Villa to play his natural position anyway. So underrated, the Earl of Barrett. Right, let's go on to some anomaly this time. This was a hyped signing for Villa. I remember at the time
I was so happy to sign this man.
This man was going to take us to the promised land. This man was going to give us the fourth dimension. Sasha Cercic.
Wow. 4 million English pounds on a Big Brother contestant by the end of it. I mean, where do we begin with Sasa Cercic? I mean, I suppose we have to frame it, don't we, that he burst onto the scene at Bolton Wanderers, which doesn't sound particularly sexy when you say it now. But he was just skillful on some dreadful pitches. And it seemed like every single week he was doing something, either creating or scoring.
It was like the match of the day highlights, yeah. Man, wasn't he?
Yeah. And he had charisma too, and it was maybe this was the classic Villa that we saw all of the highlights, and Bolton were suspiciously quite happy to have us take him off their hands.
Only one season.
Mm. What do we want to say? I think that quickly I think both Villa and he regretted the move because he had a lifestyle. Is that legally acceptable way of, we want to broach that here, that things just broke down. This was a guy who was turning
what was
up
his lifestyle?
Well, he turned up for work in a bus that he bought at Bodymore Heath. So.
Didn't somebody call him like the Serb George Best or something?
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, a quote sticks in my mind, and we were jumping around, so I apologise to the listeners. But when he did move to the MLS, he stated that he wanted to become the Dennis Rodman of the MLS. So.
He did have the haircut.
he was just. I mean, he did everything. I mean,
words are failing you.
Words fail. The thing is about Cercic was that I had to Google a piece. I wrote probably one of the only researched pieces I ever did on the Villa Underground, and it was 2011, and it stands up now. It stands up now, and it is almost like something that's. If it was scripted, you'd say, well, that's too far-fetched. Chop that out, you know.
What was the gist of this article?
He had a nose job.
Come on, tell us more.
he protested. When we'd sold him to Palace, he protested on NATO attacks on his home city of Belgrade. You know, he did a vigil at Downing Street.
Yeah? I didn't know about this.
He had the amazing haircut that Mark Draper decided to copy, and
he went bleachy blonde, didn't he?
You know, he got into huge, huge issues for politicising the game through the FA and from UEFA. He was defined by the New York Times as being talented but temperamental. That's an understatement.
Yeah, I know the Times over here described him as one of the worst Premier League signings ever. You know, at the time he was on 11 grand a week. Mm-hmm. Which was an astronomical amount for a player that was very much not at the top of his game. He'd have probably been one of our highest earners. He was kind of only there to be like, you know, a bit of a buddy for Villa. Buddy for Savo, wasn't he?
He was an absolute flop. I mean, there's some great. He was good for a quote though. So he was quoted in.
Have you got the quote that I'm thinking of? Well, to do with the women.
Well, I was going to say he was quoted in the Spanish press as saying, "I would not sign for another club." Not even for $10 million.
$15 million.
$15 million. Now you might be mixing your 15s up. But if they offered me 15 women from all around the world, it would be different. I would satisfy them all like they'd never been satisfied before. I can't achieve an orgasm by looking at a teammate, but it would be different with Cindy Crawford. That's The Guardian.
Do we actually remember him doing anything on the field?
I can't remember.
He scored in the cup, didn't he? He scored one goal, I think, against Derby.
Yeah, never scored in the league.
I mean, I remember seeing him play, and he had a couple of sort of all right games. You know, he carried the ball well, and he was good on the ball. But it was that thing of we're expecting the world, and we're getting nowhere near that. You know, this is a side that had sort of Taylor, Townsend, Draper. You know, you had consistent good performers from the season before.
Didn't when we went to Bodymore and Ian Taylor was there and we were chatting, didn't he call him out on his training or something?
Well, he didn't put any bad attitude, I think, was what the...
Yeah, because he's been called out over the years in public. I mean, he's one of those players that they don't seem to care about throwing under the bus because actually what he was a bit of a...
Well, he owned a bus, a party bus.
throw him under his own bus.
I mean, there was another strange thing that I saw, that because he wasn't playing, and this was at a time of pre-Schengen, but pre the ease that you could move across the European states, that Villa was at risk of becoming ineligible to play because of the then employment laws. So yeah. So he just married someone, a Birmingham-based...
One of the 15 Birmingham women that we gave him to sign.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't and Cindy course, Crawford.
No.
Right, anyway, I think we know where we're going with this one. Underrated or overrated? Some good quotes. I mean...
Listen, he retired at 30. I mean, we're talking about, was he underrated in terms of his football career, his media career? Because he went on to win Serbian Big Brother. And despite constant...
Did he?
Despite being saying he was going to leave every day, which is probably like his football career, he actually won the show and €50,000 with it.
Because he had a football academy like recently in London somewhere.
Wow.
So I think he's still in this country. He didn't completely beat it.
Yeah, I'm just going to go overrated.
We can only judge him in the hemisphere of Villa, so I'm saying overrated because we thought he was going to be something when he actually came to Villa at the time. He was like somebody who might give us a bit more dimension than Mark Draper, who actually...
he was actually quite good.
Yeah, well, he was meant to be better than he was. But anyway, that's for another underrated, overrated.
Yeah, like so many, it was the one good season and then he flopped.
Overrated.
Yeah.
Sasa Cercic, the Serbian Neil Lamptey, overrated.
Right, let's close off the show by discussing what modern day calls the legend, but we'd like to have a more rational look and give him one of the categories of legend, hero, or cult favourite, Mr. Juan Pablo Angel, somebody who had a decidedly rocky start at Villa. Mm. He's somebody that after the first season at Villa, the fans had so much sympathy for him that it was like they were on his side against the club because the club completely ballsed it up, being clueless, really.
Well, when it
came to integrating a player from, thinking you're clever because you've got one of River Plate's, was it three witches, four witches?
Well, Saviola was the,
Pablo Aimar as well, didn't they?
Well, they did.
Yeah, I think they were called the three witches, but they were just devastating their front three.
Mm. Well, for those that don't know that he was, I still think, despite perhaps not rising to the heights that we'd wanted from Juan Pablo, I still think it was a coup to sign him.
But we're talking about there's a story there, isn't there, in terms of his journey at Villa? Because at the start, he was on, we were almost thinking, right, he's just crap, was getting rid of him. But he was, back in Argentina, I mean, he's obviously Colombian, but when he was playing for River Plate, he was one of, almost like a mythical team.
Oh, yeah. At a very young age as well. They won major honours, and I'm pretty sure they won the Copa Libertadores, which is the South American equivalent of the Champions League.
In those Copa games, I think he scored like 16 in 25 games. He even scored like goal a game, man.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier on about the lack of atmosphere in stadiums. I mean, it couldn't be more the polar opposite, that you are, revered as a godlike figure. Even now you look at some of the River Plate articles from back then, and it was like, it was like genuinely them losing a son when he left.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen pictures of like their fans with like, angel wings and all that kind of stuff. And, those, as you say, there's articles on those three players. And it's he is part of the mythology there, even though he did actually play many more games for Aston Villa in the end. But he scored more goals for them.
I mean, we could talk all night about Juan Pablo. Initially, it was the dreadful way that he was, I don't even know what you even call it, that he was just not supported in any way in his arrival in the UK. His wife was near death, really, when shortly after giving birth. And but by his own admission, he was very isolated, couldn't speak the language, facing the prospect of, you can't imagine what might be going through one's mind if that was unfolding around you. The club were very, very slow. I mean, later acknowledging their shortfalls, and I think that's what prompted, I think there was a very good translator put in place that Angel attributed to, I think, him, I don't know, resurrecting his Villa career to some extent, but actually use it to take your word to integrating into British life and Villa culture, I suppose, to a degree. But I can always remember growing up and look and watching him, that I thought that you saw the transformation in Angel, where that first few months where he was with us, he looked like someone who wasn't getting any sleep. He looked withdrawn. He looked like football was the last thing on his mind. And I think
his positioning was all, he just didn't have any mojo.
Well, he was mentally shot, wasn't he? He'd been brought in as the marquee player, paraded, and his life was falling apart in those initial days and weeks. at a time when Aston Villa desperately needed an iconic striker. My other recollection would be is that when he did start to, you know, he scored his first goal against Coventry City to pretty much relegate them. And I remember the whole tent, you know, there was pretty much a pitch invasion because, as you said at the outset, that he'd become that message and that understanding of what he'd gone through. Yeah. Had reached the terraces. And I think from there on, Angel never hit the heights. I don't think, you know, there was little rumours for a period that Chelsea were interested in him because he was technically excellent. I think he lacked pace.
I kind of lacked players around him sometimes.
Absolutely did not have very many. There was no one in the supporting cast that if you come from a trio of Saviola and Aymar, and I'm sure that if you look at that list, there'll be other players that moved to Europe. And then you find yourself playing with... dare I do the role of shame?
I don't want to throw people under
Lee Hendry.
I don't want to throw them under Churchich's bus, but in my lifetime, not many Villa strikers have got over 20 goals in all competitions, no. And he managed to get that. And that's when you thought, happy days, hallelujah. You know, after all that adversity, he's kind of made it.
Well, he was a likeable figure, and he did come across as genuine, and I think he suffered as much, you rightly said, for the lack of supporting cast around him. At a time when Villa were, you know, he was one of the, I think he left it almost as soon as Martin O'Neill arrived.
Yeah.
And without wanting to talk up O'Neill's era too much, that I do wonder what would have happened if Angel had come 2 or 3 years later, that with better players and with better buying around him. You know, those final Ellis years were stagnant. There was no investment. There was no money to invest. You know, Ellis found himself owning a football club when he didn't have the pockets to.
Yeah, but
to
I think
finance it.
Engel was almost like his last roll of the dice because he came in like 2001, and you'd seen by Villa's performance at Wembley against Chelsea in the 2000 FA Cup that we needed some sparkle or something. And this was what we were hoping for. But, you know, as we just alluded to, he didn't really have a supporting cast to, you know, really maximise what he could have done.
He was one of my, and still is probably one of my favourite players that I've seen down there. And it took so fucking long to replace Dwight York with a genuine like-for-like. You know, Dublin was a good player, but Angel had X factor. And it was, as Dan said, you know, that period when he first arrived in that sort of second half of the season, he obviously found it very difficult. And then he got the goal against Coventry, and you could just see the weight lifting off his shoulders. And then the season after, he was unbelievable.
When he scored that goal against Chelsea, that was like when you rubber stamped him
in the
League Cup game.
Yeah, he had, I think, he's about 5 seasons at Villa, something like that. But he had 2 seasons when he was just on, and it was his second season at Villa. And then the first year under O'Leary, when we probably should have got top four and faded in the last few weeks of the season. But that season, he was just banging him in, and he was one of those genuine, proper goal scorers. You know, he was brilliant in the air he wasn't a huge guy, incredible in the air, had a great shot on him. If you put him in front of goal, if you put him in front of goal, you fancied him to score.
It's his Alice band. Alice band.
Very sort of tricky. I suppose he's almost like, you know, a classic South American player. He's everything you'd expect him to be.
But that goal against Chelsea, when he put that in, I thought, oh, he's better than I thought.
Mm-hmm. And that was against, didn't he? He put a young John Terry on his backside, didn't he?
Yeah.
That night, and there was
he was miles out when he pinged that.
Yeah, because that was the quarterfinal, wasn't it? And then he went to Bolton in the semi final and scored that ridiculous goal from the touchline, which was just unbelievable.
The looper went out into orbit first.
It reminded me of that Saunders goal at Villa Park.
Yeah,
was that against Ipswich?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
and that was on the touchline. I mean, I remember going to that game that night. Mm-hmm. It was like two individual performances from either side just dominated the game. They had JJ Okocha and we had Juan Pablo.
That goal deserved to be a winning goal, or at least on the winning team.
Yeah, and I remember him scoring a worldie at the whole tend. I think it was against Bolton where the ball got laid back to him.
And placed it.
And he just passed it into the top corner. It was unbelievable. It was one of those ones where you see it go in, you go, yeah, good goal. Then you see the replay, it's like, oh, fuck, he's literally side-footed it in from about 25
like he's
yards.
In his house slippers.
Yeah, he just passed it in the top corner. It was an unbelievable goal.
Did he score a hat-trick against the Wolves?
Yes, he did. And
was it a hat-trick or did he score two?
No, it was a hat-trick at the Molyneux. I was there, yeah.
I remember the last one because he scored, didn't he, with the outside of his right foot?
Well, that was that was one where he got put through, and I suppose what we're sort of doing is underlying his technical ability that when he was on form and
we're basically masturbating over Engel at the moment. That's been the last 2 or 3 minutes.
We're talking about him like he lifted the European Cup with Villa, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it anyway. It was a great hat trick at the Molyneux, and it was topped off by a through ball where he had a full run on goal. But the third goal for his hat trick, he's quite a way out when he side foots it past the goalkeeper. It's such a casual. And then for those who remember it, that he wheeled away, and the away following had that entire lower tier.
Yeah,
of the side, the standard side on
it's
at the
Steve Ball stand, isn't it? Yeah,
and I just thought that was a great moment, really.
He was phenomenal that season.
That's why I remember that hat trick for sure,
because it was that era when Dublin has kind of come to the end of his Villa time. I think he was starting to play centre back then, but Vassell had come through, and they actually had quite a good partnership at times. But you almost wish he'd had a genuine partner, because Merson was there for a while of his Villa career, but by that point
he was troubled.
Yeah, he was troubled, and then he kind of left, and you think if he'd have had Merson on peak form.
Or if he had Vassell, how he used to play for England.
Yeah,
I was going to say, Vassell had all of the pace and none of the technical ability.
But he was fucking good for England.
Yeah, he would do overhead kicks for England.
on his debut.
It was a real shame.
Who the fuck's this guy?
With Angelo,
it
all just sort of petered out. And then when he left, it was like, well, yeah, he's probably got to go, really. And it was a real sort of damp squib of an ending, really. You kind of wanted him to go out.
He didn't peak, did he?
No, and you almost deserve to have that moment where you think, like a lot of Villa fans say about like a Grealish or Barry or Milner, where you think, yeah, they're going to go and get a bigger, better deal. And his career never really topped it then.
No, he went to the MSL and that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think he ended his career with his boyhood club. Is it National?
Yeah, obviously he came back to Villa Park, didn't he? Was it last season or this season? He was paraded at half time, wasn't he?
Mm.
And got a brilliant reception.
He did both coasts. He did New York Red Bulls and LA Galaxy. I think Chivas as well, while they were still in existence.
Mm.
But he did, just one final thing. There's a mark of a great goal scorer, like your main man scorer, is even when you're getting beaten, like if you get beat 3-1, if your top goal scorer is getting that goal, and he used, you know, he got to the stage where he did that for a season or two, win, lose, or draw, he was always scoring.
Yeah. Yeah,
his tally of getting over 20 was always going up. It's almost like you get beat, but as long as he scores, at least you get something from that game, because you always want him to get over 20 goals.
Yeah, and I think just to underline that point, I would agree with that. And he's one of very few strikers who we've had in probably 20 years now, that, and I would include the current squad in this, is that through that type of goal scoring, it stops those 1-0s being defeats. They become 1-1s, and those 1-1s become 2-1 wins often. And that was where Angel, he could score a goal out of nothing, not in a Benteke type way. You know, he wasn't, you know, nearly physical or anything like that, but he had the technical ability to get that goal that, yeah, I dare say more often than not, it was the 3-1s, but...
But I think the better the play around him, the better he became.
Yeah, he needed service. He wasn't like a Benteke where
he's not going to be chasing hopeless causes, is he?
No, and although he was a class player, he wasn't going to win you a game on his own. He'd give you a chance. If you put it in the 6-yard box, he'd always be there. And 9 times out of 10, he'd put it away. But if you didn't give him service, he wasn't going to... Like someone like an Abraham in the Championship, where he'd just chase everything and he'd know he'd always get a chance.
Yeah.
Villa at that point, especially in the latter years under O'Leary, where the team had become so stagnant, he was feeding on scraps.
Mm-hmm.
Right, let's round this off. What tag would you give him? Legend, hero, or cult favourite?
I'd go hero.
Yeah, I would lift him above just a cult favourite, because he did. It was that, as I said, it was a journey with him. It was like a story with him, where after a poor start, he got the crowd on his side. They were willing him because of what had happened, and they'd actually taken his side against the club, and they got their reward. So yeah, I would say hero. And you know, not many Villa players, strikers, get over 20 goals in a season, so let's go for that.
Yeah, I'd list him as a hero too, because I think calling him, I mean, he's not a legend, he didn't win any trophies or whatnot, and I think to call him a cult favourite would lower him somewhat. the backstory, the some of the great goals, some of the great memories, and both ends of the spectrum, really. My only regret would be that he didn't go on to win anything with Villa, or in my looking at some of his colleagues from River Plate and what they went on to achieve in their careers. Yeah. Feel a bit sorry that he didn't do the same.
You feel a bit sorry that he came to Villa. I think he came to Villa at the wrong time. I think in a Ron Atkinson team, even in that Martin O'Neill team, as we alluded, but that's just bet on the basic equation. If we had a 20-goal striker, we would have got into Europe. But anyway, let's get out of here. We have been chatting probably twice as long as we expected. But what else is there to do at the moment? But the shops will be opening soon. Speaking of shops, actually, do check out the My Old Man Said shop for the best deals on shirts, etc. And also, if finally I get some samples through, there may be some extra merch options for you to help support the show. And speaking of supporting the show, please do retweet and share it. We're not brown nosing anybody else in this Villaverse. We are on our own against the world. So please do. Maybe I should do something like a competition for a mug. If you retweet and like the first tweet, maybe I'll put a little mug emoji on the tweet, so you'll know which one it is. So just like that and retweet, and then I'll pick one randomly and send a mug your way. Don't consider it a bribe, just consider it a thank you. Right, let's get out of here. Until next time, please do follow on Spotify, Apple, leave us a Apple review if you can. That's much appreciated. And as I said, share a go-go. Right, until next time, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.